Shalom out of Arnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. We're in session 24, dealing with Israel present. So let's review where we were last session. Last session, we were back in 2007, June 15, 2007. Hamas forces attack Fatah in Gaza and drive them out of the Gaza Strip in brutal attacks. That was just a military coup to try to destroy Fatah so that Hamas could then control all of the Palestinian Authority. On the 15th of July in 2007, Israelite priests held their first gathering since the Temple era. Then Operation Orchard was successfully accomplished, an attack against a Syrian nuclear facility. Here was the route of the aircraft. We looked at that route, and then the target located here in the drawing. The Annapolis Conference convened and ended with high hopes for a peace solution. It did not get anywhere. Ami Oritz suffered a horrendous explosion on Purim from a planted Purim present. It turned out to be a bomb. Apparently it was an attempt to kill his dad, who was a pastor of a Messianic congregation in Ariel. Ami went through many, many months of therapy before recovering. That Passover, the Passover sacrifice, was reenacted by Jewish priests in training for the Third Temple. Levitical garments were outfitted for a potential levitical priests. Barack Obama was elected president of the United States, and he was one of the most anti-Israel presidents in current history. On December 27th in 2008, the Israeli Defense Forces launched Operation Cast Lead to halt Hamas rocket fire on Israel from the Gaza Strip. Benjamin Netanyahu became the prime minister. The Herva Synagogue was finally finished and rededicated, beautiful building. The Gaza flotilla incident occurred. Six ships left Cyprus to be intercepted by the IDF Navy. The IDF told them to change course and take their humanitarian goods to Ashdod. They refused to. The boats were boarded, and the people on the boats attacked the soldiers, resulting in injuries and deaths to these terrorists. And then the flotilla was commandeered and did take its humanitarian aid to Ashdod, where it was unloaded, expected, and then inspected, and then taken into Gaza as they intended it. Terrorism continued. Christine Lucan, an American woman, was murdered. In the Itamar massacre, the Fogel family was murdered in their bed, all five. Terrible tragedy. Gilad Shalit was released on a positive note. Here he is being welcomed by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And that brings us up to the current where we begin our next session. We're in 2012. We start on the first day of January in 2012, where Gaza fires two white phosphorus-containing mortars into Israel. They were fired into an area governed by the Eshkol Regional Council. The shells landed in an open field. They caused no injuries or damage, yet a complaint about the white phosphorus was subsequently filed with the UN because this is a military weapon fired against civilians. March 9th through 15th, 2012, Gaza-Israel clashes. Gaza militants launched over 300 rockets, Grad missiles, and mortar shells into southern Israel, wounding 23 Israeli civilians. And here is a diagram of the Hamas rocket threat. Israel retaliates with airstrikes on Gazan weapon storage facilities, rocket launching sites, weapon manufacturing facilities, training bases, posts, tunnels, and terror operatives, killing 22 militants. Four Palestinian civilians die during the clashes, though some of their deaths are found to be unrelated to Israeli actions. September 2012, Egypt-Israel border attack. Here, Islamic militants, open fire from Egypt on Israeli soldiers and civilians. One soldier is killed. November 14 through 21, 2012, the Operation Pillar of Defense. The Israeli Air Force kills Ahmed Yavari, second in command of the military wing of Hamas. And this is Ahmed Yavari, This is his car being targeted by a drone. And this is the remains of the car after the missile hit it. Israel strikes 1,500 sites in Gaza, including rocket launch pads, weapons depots, government facilities, and apartment blocks. During Operation Pillar Defense, IDF targeted 1,500 terror sites. And there's the accounting of it on this slide. The point, Gaza is not a country. Gaza is an armed camp. It's an armed camp. Gaza officials said 133 Palestinians had been killed in the conflict, of whom 79 were militants, 53 civilians, one was a policeman, and there were estimated 840 Palestinians wounded. Hamas fires over 1,456 rockets into southern southern Israel, killing six, including a pregnant woman, and injuring hundreds. Rockets are fired at Jerusalem for the first time, and then at Tel Aviv for the first time since the Gulf War. A bus is bombed in Tel Aviv on November 21st, wounding 28 civilians. Israel retaliates by bombing hundreds of military sites in the Gaza Strip. As Hamas military commander since 2002, Ahmed Jabari, was responsible for the planning and execution of countless acts of terrorism against Israelis. In 1996, he was involved in a bombing that killed 59 Israeli citizens. In 1998, he helped execute a terror attack on a school bus in Kfar Darom that killed two Israeli children. In 2006, Jabari organized a terror squad that infiltrated southern Israel, killed three IDF soldiers, and kidnapped Gilad Shalit. And here's a picture of Gilad Shalit being returned from captivity in the presence of Ahmed Jabari. Following his involvement in the October 2011 prisoner exchange with Israel, Jabari became the de facto leader of Hamas. Now, Israel attempted to work with him behind the scenes to bring calm to the region. Instead, Jabari remained committed to the Hamas agenda of destroying Israel, and he ordered or permitted a new barrage of rockets to be fired into Israel. All right, what is Israel's objectives for Operation Pillar of Defense? Well, like other nations, Israel maintains its right to self-defense against threats to its civilian population. Now, according to Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, the IDF has four main goals for the operation. Number one, strengthen Israel's military deterrence on the Gaza Strip. Two, inflict serious damage on Hamas rocket launching network. Three, deliver painful blows to Hamas and other terrorists operating in Gaza. And four, minimize damage in Israel, minimize damage to the home front. Israeli spokesman Mark Regev, and this is Mark Regev, said, "We will act until we can achieve peace and quiet for those Israeli citizens who deserve to live in peace and quiet." Thousands of reserve troops have been mobilized, but Israelis do not want to initiate a ground operation in Gaza. They've done everything to avoid it. But the magnitude of the danger to millions of Israelis, however, may leave Israel with no other choice. Israel says the operation will end when Hamas stops the rocket fire. All right, let's move to November 29, 2012, United Nations General Assembly Resolution 67/19. This resolution upgraded Palestine to non-member observer state status in the United Nations. It was adopted at the 67th session of the UN General Assembly. This was the date of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people and the 65th anniversary of the adoption by the General Assembly of Resolution 181, which dealt with the future government of Palestine. The vote was 138 for, 41 abstentions against 9, so it passed very handily. Following the successful passage of the 2012 United Nations status resolution that changed Palestine's status at the UN to that of an observer state, on January 3, 2013, Abbas signed a presidential decree, number 1, 2013, officially changing the name of the Palestinian Authority to the State of Palestine. Let's move to the next, and here is the... Excuse me, I'm a little bit ahead of my slides there. November 30th, 2012, the next day, in response to the UN approving the Palestinian UN bid for non-member observer state status, the Israeli government inner cabinet announced it approves the building of housing units in the E1 area connecting Jerusalem and Ma'ale Adumim. And here's the slide I wanted to bring up. Now, of course, we're looking at the state of Israel, and this is the Jerusalem at the end of that panhandle that is protruding into the West Bank. And here we see West Jerusalem, the panhandle, the end of the panhandle, protruding into East Jerusalem. This is the Old City. Help to orient you there. And this is the E1 zone. Now, neither Palestinians nor Israelis live in the E1 zone. And here's another clear map of the E1 zone. It connects Ma'ale Adumim block with Jerusalem. And since there are neither Israelis nor Palestinians living there, that would be a strategic place to put Israeli housing and unite those two areas, probably under as Greater Jerusalem. But anyway, at least there'd be a presence from Ma'ale Adumim to Jerusalem. All right, let's summarize 2012. An annual survey by the Shin Bet concluded that in 2012, the number of terrorist attacks in the West Bank rose from 320 in 2011 to 578 in 2012. It was accompanied by a decrease in the number of fatalities, however. During the same year, 282 attacks were carried out in Jerusalem, compared to 191 in 2011. The increase in attacks is due in part to a 68% rise in attacks using Molotov cocktails. However, the number of attacks involving firearms and explosives grew by 42%, 37 attacks compared to 26 in 2011. So terrorism still continues unabated in Israel. All right. Let's move to 2013. Let's pick it up on April 1st. Natural gas begins to flow from Tamar. 4 years after drilling began at the Tamar offshore gas field, some 80 kilometers off the Haifa shore, natural gas began flowing from the offshore platforms to Ashdod. Now, here is a map of the area, of course, and the Tamar natural gas field is in this area of the Mediterranean Sea. And here's another map, a little closer up, of the offshore natural gas fields that have been discovered. The gas fields developers and politicians hail this as an historical day. This is the Tamar floating gas platform, the infrastructure needed to bring this gas to Ashdod. The gas is now flowing through pipes to a production rig off the Ashdod shore, and will then flow onto the onshore storage facility. Use of the natural gas discovered in the Mediterranean Sea in the last few years is expected to assist the Israeli energy market and reduce electricity costs. Development of the offshore field, which included 5 drilling projects and the laying of 2 150-kilometer-long pipelines, cost 3.2 billion shekels. Yitzhak Teshuvah, CEO of Delek, Delek is the Israeli energy conglomerate, said the vision has turned into a reality. Today we are once again emerging from a state from slavery to freedom, from dependence on foreign energy to independence with natural Israeli gas sources. This is a huge accomplishment for the Israeli market and the beginning of a new era. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this is an important day for the economy of Israel. On the holiday of freedom, we're taking an important step toward independence in the field of energy. And Energy and Water Minister Silvan Shalom said, this is Israel Energy-Related Independence Day. So an important day for Israel. April 14, 2013. Israel's population grew tenfold since 1948. Just in time for Yom Ha'atzmaut, that's the Israel Independence Day, the Central Bureau of Statistics released data on Israel's population. On the state's 65th anniversary, Israel had over 8 million residents, a nearly tenfold increase over the number that lived here in 1948. A total of 8,018,000 people live in the state of Israel on Independence Day 2013. When the state was established on the 5th of the Hebrew month of Iyar in 1948, the number was 806,000, a tenfold increase in population. Today, 23 population breakdown, there are 6,042,000 Jewish people, 75% of the country's population living in Israel, along with 1,658,000 Arabs, which is 20.7% of the population. The country also has an additional 318,000 residents, 4% classified as other, including non-Arab Christians and members of other religions. Israel's population grew by 138,000 since Yom HaAtzmaut, a growth rate of 1.8%. In 2013, it was announced that over 70% of the Jewish population were born in Israel, with more than half being second-generation Israelis. So 70% are now Sabras. In 1948, only 35% were native Sabras. The rise in the metropolitan area has been another important development in Israel. In 1948, only one city, Tel Aviv-Jaffa, had more than 100,000 residents. Today, there are six cities with more than 200,000 residents: Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, Rishon LeZion, Ashdod, Petah Tikva. All right, let's move to June 4, 2013. South African lawmaker: Israel is not an apartheid state. Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mishu, an outspoken member of the South African Parliament, recently expressed ongoing frustration with accusations that Israel is an apartheid state, calling such claims an insult to what his own nation went through. Earlier this year, Dr. Mishu visited San Francisco just around the time that American universities, especially in California, were swarming with anti-Israel propagandists whose new favorite ploy is to label Israel a practitioner of apartheid against the Arabs in that region. As a black South African who lived under apartheid, in my view, Israel cannot be compared to apartheid in South Africa. Those who make the accusation expose their ignorance of what apartheid really is. Mishu explained that under South African apartheid, which was a legal system of segregation and oppression based on skin color, black people such as himself could not vote, could not travel freely, or hold high government positions. Furthermore, they were subjected to segregation everywhere, from public restrooms to schools to hospitals. Mishu stated, in my numerous visits to Israel, I did not see any of the above. Black, brown, and white Jews and the Arab minority mingle freely in all public places, universities, restaurants, voting stations, and public transportation. All people have the right to vote. The Arab minority has political parties, serves in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and holds positions in government ministries, the police force, and in security forces. In hospitals, Palestinian patients lie in beds next to Israeli Jews, and the doctors and nurses are as likely to be Israeli Arabs as they are Jewish. None of the above was legally permissible in apartheid South Africa. In short, Dr. Mishu, who heads the African Christian Democratic Party, said it was slanderous and deceptive to make such accusations against Israel. In doing so, trivializes the word apartheid, minimizing and belittling the magnitude of the racism and suffering endured by South Africans of color. In conclusion, he wrote, Israel is a model of democracy, inclusion, and pluralism that can be emulated by many nations, particularly in the Middle East. This was not the first time Dr. Mishu has spoken out on the issue. At an international gathering of legislatures in Budapest on October 31, 2011, he similarly called those who accuse Israel of apartheid as being ignorant at best and purposely deceitful at worst. Moving to October 18, 2013, Hamas admits being behind a terror tunnel. The so-called military wing of the Gaza's ruling Hamas terror group, the Izz-el-Din al-Qassam Brigades, has admitted that it masterminded the terror tunnel that has been discovered leading from Gaza to an Israeli kibbutz. The group was admitted that the tunnel was meant to kidnap Israeli soldiers. Israeli officials said Sunday that IDF soldiers had uncovered a tunnel running from Gaza and extending 2.5 kilometers, 1.5 miles, into Kibbutz Ein HaShlosha. Several days after the discovery of this tunnel, Israeli security forces discovered a second one, believed to have been dug during last November's Pillar Defense counterterrorism operation. The daily newspaper Yediot Ahronot wrote that Israel has known for over a year about the terror tunnel that Hamas was digging into its territory, but let Hamas leaders continue to pour resources into it. Sometimes, as part of the war on minds, Israel lets them invest money, rack their brains, waste human resources, and only towards the end of the digging does it hold up a stop sign, the paper's defense correspondent Alex Fishman wrote. This money should have gone to infrastructure, education, and health projects. And so here is a Hamas terror tunnel. You see, it's a pretty sophisticated tunnel with reinforced concrete. And here to give you a scale as to the size of the tunnel, a couple of Israeli soldiers in the tunnel. And you can see they can be quite deep underground. This one's quite a ways under the earth, under the surface. November 8, 2013, Hamas vows to continue digging terror tunnels. On November 8th, Arut Sheva reported a Hamas spokesman was vowing to continue to dig terror tunnels and encourage terror attacks. November 11, 2013, Yasser Arafat's remains are exhumed. In addition, Arut Sheva carried this report regarding the exhumation and testing of Yasser Arafat's remains in an attempt to confirm the cause of his death back in 2004. And again, here is Yasser Arafat's tomb in the Ramallah. Senior Palestinian Authority and Fatah leader Yibril Rajoub has appeared on PA TV and accused the U.S. of being behind former PA chairman Yasser Arafat's supposed poisoning by Israel. It's obvious that Israel wasn't alone, said Rajoub in an interview aired last week, adding that the U.S. was there. That fool known as George Bush took away Yasser Arafat's protection and gave Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon the green light to liquidate Yasser Arafat. Despite medical testimony that Arafat died in 2004 of AIDS, recent investigations in November of 2012 found a moderate possibility of polonium poisoning. The inconclusive early results were quickly jumped on by the PA, which claimed that the Jews poisoned Arafat like they poisoned Islam's prophet Muhammad. They tried to another accusation, another blood libel against the Jewish people. However, in contrast with the early accusations against Israel, the new accusation of the U.S. being involved, there are other theories. One important theory is by Fahmy Shaban. Or Shabani, I'm not sure exactly how his name is pronounced. He's a former intelligence officer for the PA. He suggested that PA leaders, including PA Chairman Mahmoud Abbas, were in fact behind the murder. That would be interesting. Well, the BBC reported the conclusions of the independent agencies analyzing the possibility that Arafat was poisoned by polonium-210. The Swiss team concluded that the results moderately supported the theory. And the Russian examiners stated that their examination did not give sufficient evidence of polonium as the cause of death. Arafat's widow did not accuse anyone and stated that her husband had many enemies around the world. And of course, there is Yasser Arafat, his tombstone, where his remains are interred. November 24, 2013, Geneva interim agreement on the Iranian nuclear program. On November 23, 2013, an interim agreement was signed between Iran and the P5+1 countries in Geneva, Switzerland. It consists of a short-term freeze of portions of Iran's nuclear program in exchange for decreased economic sanctions on Iran as the country works toward long-term agreement. The following is an excerpt from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks to the Knesset. Benjamin Netanyahu said, "I would be happy if I could join those voices around the world that are praising the Geneva Agreement. It is true that international pressure, which we applied, was partially successful and has led to a better result than what was originally planned, but this is still a bad deal. It reduces the pressure on Iran without receiving anything tangible in return, and the Iranians, who laughed all the way to the bank, are themselves saying that this deal has saved them. I spoke last night with U.S. President Barack Obama. We agreed that an Israeli team led by National Security Advisor Yossi Cohen will leave soon for the U.S. to discuss the permanent agreement with Iran. The agreement must lead to one result, the dismantling of Iran's military and nuclear capability. I remind you that only last week, during the talks, the leaders of Iran repeated their commitment to destroy the State of Israel. And I reiterate here today my commitment as Prime Minister to prevent them from achieving the ability to do so. And here is the nuclear negotiations in session. And these are the participants in the Iran nuclear capability negotiations. Now we move to 2014. Early in 2014, January 11th, experienced the death of Ariel Sharon. He suffered a major stroke on January 4th, 2006, and he died after 8 years in a coma on January 11th, 2014. He was born on February 26, 1928. Here is a photo montage of his life. This is Ariel Sharon at age 14, the young Ariel. This is Major Ariel Sharon in 1955. Next to Moshe Dayan there. This is Major General Ariel Sharon in 1973. Again with Moshe Dayan. This is a photograph during Ariel Sharon's funeral. Vice President Biden is speaking there. And of course the Arabs hate Ariel Sharon because of his unequivocal stand for Israel. And so they picture him in this Arab cartoon as dragging his sins with him down into hell. They hated Ariel Sharon. He was such a champion for Israel. July 2014, the stabbing intifada, a wave of Palestinian firebombing, car ramming, and stabbing attacks break out, mostly in the Jerusalem area, leading some to raise concerns that a third intifada, sometimes referred to as a stabbing intifada, is underway. July 8, 2014, Operation Protective Edge. Since Israel evacuated every settler and soldier from the Gaza Strip 7 years ago in hopes of stimulating the peace process, it has been attacked by terrorists. Any acts favorable to the Palestinians have only stimulated more terrorism. That's because of the Arab mentality that if you're weak, you negotiate, you give concessions. And if you're strong, you take what you want. And so every time Israel gives a concession, the Arabs think that they are weak, and that stimulates more terrorism. Thousands of deadly rockets and mortars were fired into southern Israel, causing deaths, injuries, and creating a constant state of fear and anxiety among nearly 1 million Israelis within rocket range. This barrage finally created such a threat to the security of the Israeli citizens that Israel launched Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to degrade Hamas's ability to engage in terror. And for 5 years, terrorist attacks continued sporadically before increasing dramatically in 2012. More than 1,300 rockets were fired into Israel, provoking the killing of Hamas military commander Ahmed Jabari on November 14th. And eventually Operation Pillar Defense. In the summer of 2014, violence between Israelis and Palestinians escalated with the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli and one Palestinian teenagers. Here are the three Israeli teenagers who were kidnapped and murdered, Gilad Shaar, Natanli Frankel, Eyal Yifrach. This is their grave. They were all buried together. This is their gravesite. Shortly after that, this young Palestinian teenager, Mahmoud Abu Qadir, was killed. This is his funeral. And so tensions were raised to a high point once again. Hamas greatly increased rocket fire, including a reported 131 launches between July 7th and 8th. Even on July 7th, Israel was seeking a ceasefire and de-escalation. This was confirmed by the Arabic daily Al-Hayat. So in spite of Israel trying to calm the waters, the terrorism continues. This led to the third Gaza operation in 5 years, entitled Operation Protective Edge. Operation Protective Edge. And again, what are the goals? What are Israel's goals of Operation Protective Edge? Again, let me repeat, like other nations, Israel maintains its right to self-defense against threats to its civilian population. Now, according to IDF spokesman Lieutenant Peter Lerner, the IDF's goals are to, one, stop the terror that Israel's citizens face on a daily basis. Israel also seeks to prevent tunnels from being built into Israel. And three, Israel attempts to hinder Hamas's ability to make violence against Israel's civilian population. So this terrorism is ongoing, ongoing, ongoing. You see why I named this section the unending war. All right. For 50 days of war, the home front and the soldiers in the front lines were battered by thousands of rockets and mortar shells as armed groups in Gaza fired, get this, 4,564 projectiles into Israel. Now here is a diagram of the rockets that threaten the Jewish citizenship. Here's the Qassam rocket, a shorter range rocket. Then you get to a medium range Grad rocket, then a little farther range M75 rocket, and finally their long range M302 rocket, which can reach as far as Haifa. The Israeli population that falls under that red area is all under threat. These Hamas rockets threaten the majority of Israelis' population. The statistic was one of several released by the IDF as the fighting ended. According to the Army, 3,659 rocket and mortar impact sites were found, counting those fired on IDF soldiers in Gaza. Of those that struck in Israel, 224 hit built-up areas, areas of buildings, houses, etc., schools, etc. A further 735 were shot down by the Iron Dome missile defense system. And here's the Iron Dome system, poised and ready to defend Israel. Here is an Iron Dome rocket being launched. And this is an Iron Dome interception. Quite an amazing defensive system. Also, the IDF said that there were 197 failed launchings, projectiles that never left the Gaza Strip or that did not launch at all. During the war, 70 people were killed on the Israeli side, including 64 soldiers. Gaza health officials said more than 2,100 people were killed on the Strip during the fighting, and many thousands more were wounded. The Office of the Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territories, the body responsible for running the Israeli border crossings with Gaza, said that since the operation began on July 8th, 959 tons of medicine and medical supplies have entered the Strip through the crossings, and that 5,359 trucks carrying goods entered through the Kerem Shalom crossing. So the crossing and Kibbutz Kerem Shalom were targeted by mortars and rockets throughout the war. So Israel continues to provide humanitarian aid, even when their very attempt to do so is attacked by their enemy. A total of 82,201 IDF reservists were called up during the war, including a friend of mine, a personal acquaintance. So this is not some impersonal, distant tragedy for many of us. We have friends and relatives in Israel experiencing this. Throughout the fighting, 64 soldiers were killed and 469 were wounded. During the operation, the IDF struck some 5,226 targets in Gaza, including 1,814 targets linked to rocket firing, 109 weapons depots, 85 weapons-making facilities. See, Gaza is an armed camp. All this military equipment is spread out throughout the entire Gaza Strip. Of course, that makes it very, very difficult to stop it all. The army also attacked 312 houses belonging to people who were involved in terrorism. The Air Force carried out 840 strikes in support of ground forces and 192 attacks on Hamas training bases. The destruction of Hamas attack tunnels was a central goal of the operation, and the IDF said that 32 Everyone it identified were eliminated. And here's a map of six. Six of 32 terror attack tunnels that were destroyed. According to Magen David Abdam, there were 842 Israeli casualties during the fighting. Six civilians were killed by rocket and mortar strikes, and 36 were wounded by shrapnel, including 10 civilians, 10 who were seriously injured, 6 who were moderately injured, and 20 who sustained light injuries. The MDA added that another 33 people were hurt by flying glass, and that 18 people were hurt in traffic accidents that occurred when the rocket warning siren sounded, including one person who was seriously injured. In addition, 159 people were injured while running for bomb shelters and 581 treated for shock. And on top of that, 9 people were killed in 3 terrorist attacks in Israel. So speaking of the terror tunnels, here's a view inside one of the terror tunnels. And again, there's that one that was uncovered that's so deep underground, graphically showing how deep they can be. Now notice, during Operation Protective Edge, Israel has agreed to a ceasefire 4 times, and each time Hamas has refused. They simply want to fight. And in regard to Operation Protective Edge, we read this in the LA Times in 2014, if the Israelis wanted to wipe out as many Palestinians as possible, which is the accusation, of course, genocide, never mind commit genocide, they probably wouldn't issue warnings to Gaza by phone and leaflet to get out of harm's way, which Israel did consistently. If they needed to bomb a building, they would warn the people, they'd send leaflets, get out of this building. You have so much time to leave. They did their best to prevent civilian casualties. And in regard to Operation Protective Edge, summary, Hamas puts Palestinian civilians in the line of fire to act as shields. And, you know, on the Israeli side, Israel uses weapons to protect its citizens. Notice the citizens are underground in the bomb shelter in this drawing. But Hamas uses civilians to protect its weapons. And here the weapons are in the bomb shelter. Operation Protective Edge. All right, let's move to August 4, 2014. The mega attack Israel's Gaza war prevented. Israel may or may not have achieved all its military objectives against Hamas by the time the ceasefire was imposed in Gaza, but it would appear the war effort accomplished something far more important in thwarting a planned mega attack. Israeli troops operating in Gaza confiscated Hamas documents and computers that contained details of a planned attack, a planned major assault against southern Israel. As the ground war got underway, Israel was surprised by the number and complexity of the terror tunnels that had been dug under the border, under the Gaza border and into sovereign Israeli territory. What it only learned later, after capturing the aforementioned intelligence, was that all these tunnels were part of an elaborate attack scheme. As per the Hamas documents, on Rosh Hashanah in 2014, up to 200 Hamas gunmen were to pour out of each of the dozens upon dozens of terror tunnels, many of which we now know exited inside or very near Israeli civilian communities. And while the Hamas plan is of a scope grand beyond achievability, there was no doubt that an attack of that scale would have resulted in many Israeli casualties and possibly a number of abductions. In fact, many of the tunnels uncovered were found to contain holding rooms where presumably Hamas intended to hide kidnapped Israelis. A number of the Hamas fighters captured by Israel have confirmed that the plan was real, and they said they had been promised by their leadership that the mass coordinated assault would begin the ultimate defeat of the Zionist enemy. Israel's war in Gaza, and in particular, the focus on destroying the terror tunnels, severely disrupted Hamas's plans, which the prisoners said required some 12 years in preparations. They'd been working on that for a long time. September 28, 2014, the Temple Institute raises $100,000 for the Third Temple plans. The Temple Institute's crowdfunding campaign to raise funds for the modern architectural plans of the Third Holy Temple in Jerusalem came to a close on Rosh Hashanah after surpassing its $100,000 goal in 60 days. The funds raised will be used to continue the research of the Institute and to commission additional architectural plans. The architects will fuse Jewish law with modern technology to prepare a fully modern Third Temple, kosher to the letter, but including modern conveniences like underground parking, heating, and computerized washing stations that minimize water waste. And here's a picture of a Third Temple superimposed on the Temple Mount, exactly where, of course, the Dome of the Rock sits today. All right, let's move to September 29, 2014. Israel is the only safe place for Christians in the Middle East, Nazareth priest tells the UN. Father Gabriel Nadav, and this is Father Nadav, a Greek Orthodox priest from Nazareth and a loyal citizen of the State of Israel, told the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Tuesday that Israel was the only place in the Middle East where Christian minorities are safe. In the Middle East today, there is one country where Christians are not only not persecuted, but affectionately granted freedom of expression, freedom of worship, and security, Nadav declared. It is Israel, the Jewish state. Israel is the only place where Christians in the Middle East are safe. And that's relatively so. There are a few Israeli extremists that do cause problems, but in general, Christians are safe in Israel. All right, let's move to December 30th, 2014. America says that Israel is among the top most unacceptable countries. The U.S. State Department in 2014 condemned Israel as one of the most unacceptable countries in the world, just behind North Korea. According to an article published last week by Foreign Policy, over the past year, the Obama administration, remember this is one of the most anti-Israel administrations in U.S. history, the Obama administration's State Department cited Israel for unacceptable behavior more times than Pakistan, Russia, Egypt, China, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The article examined how many times a country's actions were condemned as unacceptable, and Israel came in fourth, right after Syria, Iran, and North Korea. Most of the State Department's criticisms came in response to Israeli announcements for plans to build housing in Jerusalem. So Israelis building homes is unacceptable, but Hamas rockets are okay. Mm-hmm. How can building homes in Jerusalem be condemned on par with the actions of nations repeatedly engaged in aggressive and murderous violence towards their own civilian populations and absolutely no regard for human rights? And this is, of course, speaking to the UN Human Rights Council. You know, pick it up, you guys. Anyway. I better not get off on some kind of a track there. Israel's Ynet news portal found that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon used the word concerned 140 times in 2014 in statements about world events, and Israel was the most concerning country of all. Well, this is just following in line with Zechariah 12:3, which states, "It will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples, and all who lift it will be severely injured," and here's the key statement, "and all nations of the earth will be gathered against it." And we see that gathering of all the nations of the earth against Israel coming into place even today. All right, December 31st, the end of 2014, Israel hails the highest immigration figure in a decade. The number of Jews moving to Israel in 2014 leapt to its highest figure in a decade, with Western Europe leading the way, the immigration ministry said. Immigration hit a 10-year high with the arrival of some 26,500 new residents, according to a joint statement with the Jewish Agency, a quasi-governmental organization tasked with encouraging Jews to move to Israel. This marks a significant 32% increase over last year's approximately 20,000 immigrants, the statement said. This was a year of record-breaking aliyah, Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky stated, using the Hebrew word for immigration to Israel. It also was an historic shift. For the first time in Israel's history, the number of immigrants who came to Israel from the free world is greater than immigrants fleeing from countries in distress. For the first time ever, France provided the biggest number, More than 6,600 Jews moved to Israel. That was nearly twice the 3,400 that arrived in 2013. Overall, immigration from Western Europe increased 88% with the arrival of 8,640 people, compared with 4,600 last year. Some 620 came from Britain, compared to 520 the year earlier. The number from Italy doubled to 340. Around 240 arrived from Belgium, a slight decrease. The number from Germany remained stable at about 120. Immigration from the former Soviet Union countries saw a 50% increase with the arrival of some 11,430 people, compared to 7,610 in 2013. And this was largely driven by an exodus from the conflict-racked Ukraine, where the number surged 190% to 5,840. More than half of all people moving to Israel in 2014 were under 35, among them 5,300 children and 8,200 adults between the ages of 18 to 34. Tel Aviv was the city with the highest immigration number of immigrants, around 3,000, and this was followed by the northern coastal city of Netanya and then Jerusalem. All right, let's move from the last day of December 2014 to 2015, the next year. In 2015, Israel ranks in the top 20 nations of the world in the UN's 2015 Human Development Index. February 4, 2015, Hamas is fast rebuilding guerrilla terrorist forces in the Gaza. Hamas and allied terrorists in Gaza have spent recent months intensively rebuilding their guerrilla terrorist capabilities, which sustained significant damage during Operation Protective Edge. Their aim is to recover the military infrastructure that was damaged and return it to full capabilities and broaden it, according to a recent report by the Amit Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center in Tel Aviv. To that end, Hamas has allocated the necessary funds, personnel, and equipment despite the shortages suffered by the civilian sector of the Strip. This stands out especially against the background of the ongoing delay in the civilian recovery in the Gaza Strip, the report said, adding that it illustrates well, as in the past, Hamas's priorities clearly lie in rebuilding military capabilities at the expense of civilian needs. Dr. Reuven Ehrlich, head of the Terrorism and Intelligence Center, told the Jerusalem Post, "We see that when it comes to military programs, resources flow without a problem." So the program is aimed at both replenishing the military wing's ranks and support for Hamas among the Gazan population, which is suffering extreme hardship in the aftermath of the conflict with Israel. Hamas began to reconstruct its network of tunnels within Gaza, and Israel is watching out for any signs of cross-border attack tunnels as well. Hamas's domestic rocket production is rapidly replenishing the Islamist regime's arsenal of projectiles. So the beat goes on. March 16, 2015. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says no to a two-state solution on the eve of the election. May 13, 2015. The Vatican recognizes the state of Palestine in a new treaty. Thanks a lot, Vatican. September 16, 2015. Riots on the Temple Mount. Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestinian Authority, was interviewed on Palestinian television about the violent riots on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And during the interview, he said, "Al-Aqsa is ours. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is ours. Everything is ours, all ours. They, the Jews, have no right to desecrate them with their filthy feet, and we won't allow them to." There's your peace partner. There's Israel's peace partner. October 19, 2015, worst outbreak of violence in years. 32 Palestinians and 7 Israelis were killed during the first 2 weeks of October. This was the biggest increase in violence in the area in recent years. The Palestinians claim increasing infringement by Israelis on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Palestinian teenagers led the violence by stabbing Israelis in so-called lone wolf attacks. This is very different from the political and organized support experienced during the first and second intifadas. These are independent attacks. And now we come to 2016. Some good news on 2016. IDF Field Hospital is rated the world's best. The IDF Medical Corps Field Hospital is rated the world's best by the World Health Organization, becoming the first field hospital to achieve WHO's Type 3 rating for providing inpatient referral surgical care along with emergency and surgical care. September 14, 2016. United States commits $38 billion over 10 years to military assistance for Israel. That is good news. December 23, 2016. U.S. abstains on United Nations resolution condemning Israeli settlements, allowing the motion to pass. The U.S. was allowing Israel to be condemned for building homes. All right, moving to 2017. Gal Gadot, star of the movie Wonder Woman. Gadot becomes the highest grossing actress of the year, amassing $1.4 billion worldwide. She's a wealthy young lady. February 6, 2017. Israel passes a law retroactively legalizing almost 4,000 settler homes built on Palestinian land. February 15, 2017, U.S. President Trump is open to the one-state solution. This is a change in the decade-long U.S. policy of advocating for a two-state solution. April 6, 2017, Russia recognizes West Jerusalem as the future capital of Israel and East Jerusalem as the capital of the future Palestinian state. So there's a bit of conflict there between those who are satisfied with a one-state solution and those who want a two-state solution. We'll see how this all works out in the years to come. Okay, let's move to May. May 1st, 27. Hamas declares a willingness to accept an interim Palestinian state alongside of Israel, but it must be along pre-1967 boundaries. May 14, 27, the population of Israel reaches 8.8 million. And in the summer of 2017, Israel expended quite a bit of effort on emergency aid. Over the course of the summer, Israeli government and non-governmental groups sent aid and personnel following natural disasters to Texas, Mexico, Haiti, the Caribbean, Florida, Puerto Rico, Nepal, and Sierra Leone. So Israel reaches out to help others in spite of the fact that resources are limited. December 6, 2017, President Trump recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital and he orders the U.S. Embassy to move. This is President Trump's order to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And subsequently that occurred on May 14th in 2018. The U.S. Embassy was dedicated in Jerusalem. And here is a picture of that embassy dedication ceremony, something that should have happened decades ago. But President Trump followed through on a good move there. 2018, Israel ranks in the top 10 most powerful and innovative nations. As we move to our next year here, it is in the top 10 of the most powerful and innovative nations. U.S. News and World Report ranks Israel's the eighth most powerful nation in the world. Bloomberg News names the Jewish state as the 10 most innovative worldwide, edging out the United States. Little tiny postage stamp Israel. Eighth most powerful, 10th most innovative. Israel continues to move toward becoming one of the most influential, if not the most influential nation on the face of the earth. And this is fully in accordance with Ezekiel 38:12. In Ezekiel 38:12, we read that Gog comes to capture spoil and to seize plunder and to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited and against the people who are gathered from the nations who have acquired cattle and goods. And here is the key statement, who live at the center of the world. Well, obviously, Israel is not the geographic center of the world. It doesn't mean that. The expression is an indicator of her importance and influence in the world. She will be one of the most influential, if not the most influential country in the world. May 14th, 2018, Israel's population in 2018 stands at 8.84 million. The U.S. Embassy opens in Jerusalem. Violence and protest ensue. Then we move to violence and protest. We know about that. July 19th, 2018, the Israeli Knesset passes a law declaring Israel to be a Jewish state. Hebrew is the official language, and the undivided Jerusalem as its capital. September 17, 2018, missile strikes hit multiple targets in western Syria. Late on September 17, 2018, missile strikes hit multiple targets in the Syrian government-controlled western Syria. These strikes were conducted by the Israeli Air Force. The attack involved four F-16 fighter jets launching GBU-39 bombs at industrial sites at Latakia. The missiles hit the Institute of Technological Industries, a subsidiary of the Syrian Ministry of Defense, on the outskirts of Latakia. The missiles targeted ammunition depots. Two people were killed and 10 injured. October 17, 2018, the Barkhane Industrial Park shooting. On the morning of October 7th, 2018, a Palestinian gunman opened fire on several Israelis in the Barkhane Industrial Park, killing two Israelis and critically injuring another. The shooting incident was declared a terrorist attack by the IDF. It was the first attack in the park and the second fatal attack in the West Bank to occur in 3 weeks. A 23-year-old Palestinian who had worked in the factory where the shooting took place. The Palestinian used a homemade gun in the attack. He was known locally as Carlo, according to an IDF spokesman. The IDF forces conducted an intensive 2-month manhunt in order to capture the militant Carlo, who fled the scene. And the IDF also arrested some relatives of the assailant. They were probably housing him, hiding him for those 2 months. November 11, 2018, Gaza-Israel clashes. Gaza-Israel clashes began on the 11th of November 2018 when a botched Israeli covert operation carried out in the Khan Yunis area of the southern Gaza Strip killed 7 Palestinian militants and 1 Israeli soldier. And here is a depiction of that clash. Exchanges of fire lasted for 2 more days until a ceasefire was achieved with Egyptian mediation. Some minor incidents and protests followed some 2 weeks after the ceasefire with decreasing intensity. December 4, 2018, the Israeli military launched Operation Northern Shield to destroy cross-border tunnels built by Hezbollah along Israel's border with Lebanon. The operation's declared goal was to locate and destroy Hezbollah tunnels that cross the blue line from Lebanon into northern Israel. And according to Israel, this operation is part of the ongoing Iran-Israel proxy conflict. The United Nations interim force in Lebanon acknowledged the existence of 4 tunnels near the Israel-Lebanon border, but said UNIFIL at this stage can confirm that 2 of the tunnels cross the blue line. This would be in violation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, which helped end the 2006 Lebanon War. All right, December 21st, 2018, Israel announced its departure from UNESCO, citing bias, and there was a lot of bias in UNESCO. Now we move to 2019. We'll pick it up on March 25th. U.S. President Donald Trump signs a proclamation recognizing the Golan Heights as part of the State of Israel. And so official U.S. maps now include the Golan Heights as part of Israel. Here's a map of the region. This is the Golan Heights, just to give you a fix on where it's located. And here is a map of the area in detail. This is now considered part of Israel by the U.S., by the United States. May 3rd, 2019, Gaza-Israel conflict. A Gaza-Israel conflict escalation began on May 3rd, 2019, after 2 Israeli soldiers were injured by sniper fire from the Gaza Strip during the weekly protests at the Israel-Gaza border. And this is a picture of that Gaza-Israel border protests. In response, the Israeli Air Force carried out an airstrike, killing 2 Palestinians. Following this, hundreds of rockets were launched from Gaza at Israel, while the Israeli Air Force struck numerous targets within the Gaza Strip. In addition, Israel increased its troop presence on the border. A ceasefire was facilitated by Egyptian mediators on May 6th. May 14th, 2019, Eurovision Song Contest held in Tel Aviv. Eurovision Song Contest 2019 was the 64th edition of the contest. The contest took place in Tel Aviv, Israel, following Israel's victory in the 2018 contest in Lisbon, Portugal, when the song Toy was performed by Netta. This was the third time Israel has hosted the contest, having previously hosted it in 1979 and 1999. All right. Well, this wraps up my current version of the First Regathering Modern Israel, Section 4. Let's quickly review where we've been. We started out with the spiritual war, the biblical background. Then we moved to the historical background, a survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. Section 3 was called The End of Exile, 1839 to 1947, and the Modern Zionist Movement. There we saw a certain theme. The theme is illustrated by this map. Here's the original area allocated for the Jewish National Home in San Remo. But then Great Britain divided up the mandated area, and the Jewish National Home was reduced by 75%. Then the Peel Partition Plan of 1937 further recommended that the Jewish National be reduced even further to the Galilee and the seacoast. And finally, the Woodhead Commission Partition Plan recommended that the Israeli homeland be reduced to a small strip along the coast. So the theme we witnessed is the shrinking Jewish state. That's the theme of that particular section of our study, Section 3. Now we move to Section 4, the unending war, 1948 to the present, dealing with the modern state of Israel. And we saw another theme. This is the state of Israel. The Jewish areas that were purchased and occupied by Jewish people are in the white area. Well, in 1947, the UN felt that the Jewish National Home needed to be reduced, but not quite as far as previous recommendations. And so this was the UN partition plan. Well, that gave the Jewish people, the Zionists, a little more territory than they previously occupied. But this was refused by the Palestinians, and the War of Independence ensued, leading to this gain by Israel. She gained all the territory except the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And then recently, as Israel has continued to mature, the West Bank is now starting to disintegrate. And so what's the theme we're watching now? The theme we're seeing now is the shrinking Palestinian state. And this is fully in accord with Genesis 12:3, which states, "I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse." The Palestinian Arabs have always tried to curse Israel with the destruction of the state, and they now are experiencing cursing themselves. And Galatians 6:7, "Do not be deceived, God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he will also reap." The Palestinian Arabs tried to shrink away the state of Israel, and now the state of Palestine is being shrunken away. All right, that was the section number 4, the unending war. I'd like to move now to section number 5, Israel future. And by Israel future, I mean the near future. That is, what does the Bible tell us about Israel prior to the tribulation period? Now, the book of Revelation is dedicated to explaining the tribulation, and that's a very extensive and involved class. And I don't want to go there at this time. Instead, I want to cover the events we can expect to see somewhere in the time frame between today and the tribulation period, the near future before the tribulation. So I call the class, "The Romans and Russians Are Coming, Oh My." That's my spoiler. And the class will cover Daniel 2, 1-49, Daniel 7, 23-28, and Ezekiel 38 and 39. So this then is where we'll be going. As we get a glimpse at what the modern state of Israel will encounter during the years ahead. So we'll hope to see you back in our next session. We'll begin session 25 with the exploration of Israel future. Thanks for being our students. Lehitraot.